must-win games as they try and get back up to 500. Is with two outs, this one is first pitch, hit to the right side of the infield, it's off the end of the glove, now trying to get him at first. Yes, they got the tag. Barely tagging him right there. Somehow, that is out number three. Technically 1-3 on the putout because it was off the end of the pitcher's glove trying to recover it, and ends up in the first baseman's as Bryant goes over and tags him for out number three. So the Raptors go down 1-2-3 in the ninth, and the final score of the game, it's 12-3 Wausau here from the Woodchucks home, from the Burrow. And that's going to do it for the game. So we're going to go ahead and take a quick break. And when we come back, we finally got that post-game show for you before we go ahead and hit the road back to Wisconsin Rapids for a two-game set. We'll come back talking about the game, recapping that, and a look back at all of that. Coming up next here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
It's the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. Dismantling the IRA and other federal clean energy incentives will add a half a gigaton of greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. That's according to modeling from Princeton University. House Republicans passed aggressive cuts to clean energy incentives in their latest budget. The Senate is now considering the bill. The Public Service Commission of Wisconsin has given the green light for a major build-out of fossil fuel-burning power plants in Wisconsin. We Energies wants to build new gas plants and operate them for 30 years, largely to meet the needs of Microsoft's new AI data center. It's turtle nesting season, and the DNR is asking drivers to slow down on roads near wet areas, lakes, and rivers. Wisconsin's 11 turtle species lay eggs from late May through June, when you can often see them along roads and in yards. You can help keep them safe by being alert when driving through their habitat. For a deep dive into environmental issues, check out my Defender podcast at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hear that? That's the sound of your life. Perfectly imperfect. Beating in rhythm to the world you've created. But every time you drive after drinking, the music gets drowned out. Your life sounds pretty great. Don't let a buzz ruin it. Buzz driving is drunk driving. Don't drive buzzed. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Let's get back to Raptors baseball here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
Final score 12-3 from Wausau, Wisconsin, as the Raptors fall to the Woodchucks in game number 4 on the season. They drop to 1-3. Wausau improving to 2-2 on the year. And coming up next for the Raptors, they will head home to face Rockford. Tomorrow's night's pitcher is still undecided by Rockford. But for the Raptors, they're going to be sending out Seth Spencer for his first time in a Raptors uniform. And, well, Tristan Crusenberry will go the next day against Rockford. Even though he pitched in today's game, he only went a little bit of time. He pitched 2 innings on 35 pitches, so they're hoping that he'll be good to go on short rest for the game on Saturday. But tomorrow night, it's against Seth Spencer as, well, Wausau is going to get back on track, trying to move up the standings here in the Great Lakes West. Taking a look at them, Green Bay entered today at the top of the standings, 2-1. But behind them, Fond du Lac and Madison both were 1-1 as they had a game that was suspended after just 2 innings of action. Wausau and Wisconsin Rapids were tied for 4th in the standings, with Lakeshore behind them sitting in last place. And, well, the Rapids got Lakeshore coming up in just a little bit, so that would be a big one if they can get back on track there. But they've got to do some work against Rockford, and Rockford starting the season undefeated, and they have looked pretty dang good in doing so. So maybe not the team that they want to face, but Green Bay and Rockford facing each other right now. Green Bay's actually got the lead, so maybe the Raptors have already got the toughest of those two out of the way with Green Bay. And now they've got to get the win against Rockford. Well, taking a look back at the way that this game has gone, it started off in the Raptors' favor. They were up 3-0 in the top of the first. Started off with a walk, and then Drew Thompson getting a single, although Jack Guerrero was out on the runner's interference. Ashton Zacher followed up with a walk, so you got runners on first and second. Royce Clayton Jr. loads them up, with a single of his own and then an RBI hit from Hiroto Kobayashi. And that was followed by Noah Ruiz getting on base via an error from a fielding error from the pitcher. And then finally, Luke Skinner up at the plate, fielder's choice, that ended up sending home a run. And while the game was a final score of 3 for the Rafters, all 3 of those came in the first inning. But since that point, it was pretty consistent scoring from Wausau. Didn't score any in the first, but in the bottom of the second, 3-0 lead for the Rafters, but not for long. 4-run score for Wausau. They take the lead 4-3 thanks to a ton of runners reaching. It was a walk, a single, a walk, a single, a walk, and then a sacrifice fly. There was a caught stealing in there as well, and a runner trying to advance from second to third. That's why there was only one batter recorded out there, but through the first 11 batters, just one was recorded out on Wausau, and that helped them get right back into this game. They took the lead by 1 in the third inning. They added one more run on a leadoff walk from Dylan Schlotterbeck. He basically created this run himself. He went to second on a ground out, then stole third and came home on an error on the throw down to third base. In the fourth inning, they kept the scoring going. They added one more run, and that was thanks to an RBI ground out from Josh McClintock, where it sent Zach Knowlton home. In the fifth inning, though, that's where the game really got out of hand. It was 6-3 entering it, but by the time it was over, it was a big-time lead for the Woodchucks. 4 runs came across, 3 hits to start off the inning, all singles. The second one, an RBI from Easton Bryant. Third one, another single. And then Jake Weatherspoon followed with a walk. Another walk to Zach Knowlton. The first 5 runners all reached base. That walk at the end was an RBI, as it was with the bases loaded. Christian Smith-Johnson then grounded into a fielder's choice that also ended up sending home a runner, which was Keegan Jerschle, before Ryan Pruitt grounded into a double play to end the frame. Following that up, the sixth inning saw just the 1 run come across, but that made it a large 11-3 lead, and that was thanks to an RBI single from Dylan Schlotterbeck. But after that point, after a hit-by-pitch, a walk, a single, and a walk by Brent Gallegos to start off the sixth inning, then Jaffet Martinez came in, and this was one of the bright spots of the game for the Rafters. He ended up going 6 straight batters, retiring them before he was pulled from the game. Didn't want him to go too long after he pitched just yesterday. He only threw 29 pitches today, but he went 2 innings, perfect. 2 strikeouts over them, and he helped really get the Rafters back on the right track. Although, in the 8th inning, Brendan Cohen came in, and he issued up 3 singles, one of them being an RBI before he walked that last batter, and then getting out of the inning, finally on Christian Smith-Johnson's grounder. Then in the 9th inning, it was again a 1-2-3 frame for the Rafters. They went down 1-2-3 in 4 separate innings. The 4th, the 5th, the 8th, the 9th, they didn't see a single base runner. And in the also, that was the same deal with the 6th. They're actually 5 that they went 1-2-3. The 7th inning, they saw 1 base runner. The 3rd inning, they saw 1 base runner. 2nd inning, they saw 1 base runner. They did not make it past first base since that first inning when they scored 3 runs. And so they've really got to work on that offense, get that back on track, but they have a chance to do so tomorrow against Rockford. And with that pitcher still undecided, well, maybe it'll be more of a last chance and kind of catch them off guard over there in Rockford. We'll have to wait and see how that goes, and you can tune in here on WFHR for that game. And first pitch tomorrow is going to be at 6:35 p.m. So we'll have the pregame show coming to you live from 6:20 p.m. as we always do, live from Witter Field. And that'll be the same case on Saturday as well with Rockford. But of course, you can also come on out to Witter Field if you are interested in doing so. It's always a great atmosphere out there, especially over the weekends. We love to have the people come out and support their Rafters. Well, taking a look back at the final box score and some of the stats from tonight's game, it wasn't quite as impressive as yesterday's game. But a few players still ended up reaching base a couple of times. Jack Guerrero, 1-for-3 with a walk. Along with that, Hiroto Kobayashi, 1-for-3 with a walk, and he had an RBI. And it was also a 1-for-4 game with an RBI for Luke Skinner. And that's really the players have noticed from the offensive side. And I already mentioned it, pitching, but Jaffet Martinez, 2 innings pitched, no runs, no hits, no walks, 2 strikeouts, dominant stuff from him, and hopefully he can keep that rolling along. Tristan Krusenberry, not too bad when he was out there as well. issued up 2 walks in 2 innings pitched, but you'll take that from him when he was able to record those 2 innings of work on just 35 pitches, issued up just 1 earned run, 2 runs in total, didn't allow a hit, had those 2 walks and a hit by pitch, though. But that's really the biggest statistics that we're looking at. Alejandro Morales goes 2 innings, allowing 4 runs on 3 hits and 6 walks. Brent Gallegos, 3 earned runs, 5 runs in total on 1 inning pitched with 4 walks and 4 hits. And Brennan Cohen, 1 inning pitched, 1 run allowed. It was earned, 3 hits, 1 walk, did not strike out a batter. And for tonight's game, so the final score, 12-3. Then the Rafters can't quite get their second win of the year and move back to 500. They'll have a chance to do so, well, in a couple games. They hope to get a win and get back on the right track tomorrow against Rockford. 6:35 first pitch here on WHR or on Northwoods. Fletcher Anderson on the call there. I, myself, Austin Thomas, will be on the call here on WFHR, as I will be for all 72 games throughout the season. So we hope to have you tuned in wherever you are, or, of course, out at Witterfield. But that's going to do it for our post-game show. Thank you for the support tonight and all season long. And until tomorrow, thank you and have a great rest of your night. This is from WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids.
Resources away from we the people, we the public, the desperate on this planet, toward the elite. This, again, is the 99% versus the 1%. This is the billionaire class against everyone else, pure and simple. And it was never going to be anything more than that. So when I see, instead of the multiple trillions that we were promised they were going to cut, $9.4 billion? And ideological cuts that didn't necessarily need to be made? This is where I reach out to my red hats. You were all excited. They were going to slash and burn. You've been told for decades how inefficient government is, and yet, out of a multi-trillion dollar budget, you found a minuscule crumb. And I would argue that that's not even cuts. It's ideological payback. So that ultimately what it means, my red hats, no $5,000 Doge check. Sorry, you've been lied to again. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You agree? Or I want to hear someone who tells me this was a success. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, shocker above all shockers, Nebraska Republican Mike Flood, evidently to a bunch of angry constituents, admitted he didn't read the big beautiful bill. Didn't know what was in it. Anyone surprised? Anyone shocked? And the weird thing is when you look at massive bills like the big, beautiful disaster, they always tuck in their little Easter eggs throughout the bill to achieve their certain desired outcomes, be it tax cuts for pet projects, payoffs to friends and donors, you know, basic horse trading to buy votes to pass such a disaster. And this little Easter egg, a little curious to me, and it's section 70302. just one little paragraph out of this 1,118-page disaster, and it reads, quote, "No court of the United States may use appropriated funds to enforce a contempt citation for failure to comply with an injunction or temporary restraining order if no security was given when the injunction or order was issued pursuant to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 65C, whether issued prior to, on, or subsequent to the date of enactment of this section." Now, I thought this was a budget bill. What does this have to do with anything? And while not a lawyer, figured I better ask, find out what this is about. That's why I've asked Seth Goldstein to come share some thoughts. Seth is a partner at Julian Meyer Cigna and Goldstein. Seth, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So, you know, in all of these bills, there are always little things that get tucked into places. This one's gotten some attention because I don't know what it's got really to do with the budgeting process. Thoughts?
There's nothing to do with the budgeting process. This is a 2.0, what's called an Enabling Act, which was last seen in 1933, in which Trump is trying to override the judiciary branch to basically create a situation that if he issues a ridiculous executive order, that there would be no way for the courts to stop it. And then he could institute the federal government to carry out whatever nefarious plan he wants to. We saw with Birthright that had Trump had his way, he would have implemented the executive order, and there would have been thousands of people born in the United States would have no rights as citizens. And then the courts would have no right to stop it. They would be prohibited from issuing what's called a national injunction. And while they could issue an injunction for the people before the court, this would allow Trump to proceed in denying people's 14th Amendment rights.
So this is even worse than you know what I was believing. You know, it's just, this was kind of neutering the courts. This is preemptively neutering the courts for the future law breaking he plans on doing. Is that what I'm getting?
Exactly, which is really strange. You know, the right wing, the Republicans, used the Fifth Circuit to block all of Biden's executive orders, and they would what's called forum shop to these rural federal courts and get these national injunctions. And that's how they stopped labor reform during the past 4 years. Now that they're in power, they don't have use for preliminary national injunctions, so they're basically trying to get rid of them.
But isn't this, you know, a sane, rational person would go, well, why would you do this? Because at some point, you're not going to be in power. So by laying this groundwork, you're just, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword. You're just setting yourself up for future failures. Or do you think that maybe I've had people say there may never be another national election that matters. Or are you in that camp?
Well, I'm worried, right? What I see is the assault on the judiciary. The legislative branch is comatose right now with the Republicans. So I could see how Trump might try to prohibit these things. They've already decided that they don't even want to pay attention to injunctions when they're issued by the court. Look at the Garcia case. And then the Supreme Court ordered Garcia to be returned, and they ignored that as well. So I don't really have a lot of high hope for the Trump administration. But if he's successful in neutering the judiciary branch, then we've got some real problems.
What are the chances that this little nugget doesn't end up in the final bill as the Senate goes through this? Any chance that you think it gets pulled out, that someone, now that there's been some attention drawn to it? Because I'd like to know who tucked it in. I'd like to know who put it there, why it was put there, what right-wing think tank dreamt this up and war-gamed it out. I got a lot of questions.
Well, I think if the public becomes active and speaks out about it, we can defeat this. If we don't do anything about it, it's going to pass. There needs to be maximum pressure in the Senate. This provision does not fit to what reconciliation is thought to be. It is outside of the budget. And, following the rules that the Republicans have, that should not be here. Moreover, people who believe in democracy and human rights should be speaking out on it. I am, and we need to stop it. Otherwise, all of our rights could be gone with just a signature of a executive order.
Now, for all my Red Hat union members, you have recently written a piece on this being dangerous to the NLRA, and how the end of national injunctions would mean an open season on workers. What do you mean by that? How does this affect workers and their rights?
It's part of the plan, right? The plan to destroy the Natural Labor Relations Act. They fired Gwen Wilcox, the board head of it. So the next step would be, if you can eliminate national injunctions, then the board, the NLRB, could come up with some overwhelming unconstitutional administrative change and forego the Administrative Procedure Act and implement it, and there would be no way to stop it. Trump could sign an executive order eliminating the National Labor Relations Board, and there would be no way to stop that as well, because the courts would not have any injunctive powers. And then we'd have to wait for it to get up to the Supreme Court, and by that time, the damage will already have been done.
So when this little, probably 50-word little Easter egg tucked into this 1,118-page bill, this is real massive shift in power and basically creating a king, if you will.
As I said before, this is a 2.0 enabling act. This was the same way that Hitler got around the institutions that would have blocked him in 1933. And that's what Donald Trump is trying to do right now. He's trying to eliminate any type of protections people have regarding their constitutional rights.
I recently on the program, I asked, who could possibly be this generation's Richard Ley? He was the head of the labor union once Hitler disbanded independent unions. They had their one big, beautiful union, of which Richard Ley was the head from 1933 to 1945. I keep asking, is it possible? We're still going to have unions. Will they just be fascistic unions, or will they be independent ones that fight for workers' rights and wages and safety and all of those things? Or will they just be a controlling function? This seems like you could maybe sign an executive order to have one big, beautiful union.
He can do whatever he wants to do if there's no way to stop him from doing it, right? He controls the federal government. He controls the courts. I mean, not the courts, but the attorneys. And he represents the military. And with that, if there aren't any courts to stop him, he can do what he wants. So again, people have this choice of either turning their head and saying, it doesn't concern me, or they could come up and fight it. And I think that if you care about democracy, you care about human rights, you don't want to head to a fascist society, then I think you should get out and protest this and make sure that it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, but clearly, Richard, we're not 1930s Germany. This isn't the rise of the Third Reich. This is America. That stuff couldn't happen here.
Yes, it can. And we have a very fragile thing, and we saw this in several times in our history, whether it was the Palmer Raids in 1919 or the Red Scare in the 1940s. that people, you know, start following some type of ideological cult of personality, and they get rid of your rights. The Constitution, the statutes that we have are only good when they're followed and they can be enforced. If you take away the enforcement, then you're in a situation where we have no rights.
Now, you say that labor needs to do more. Are they doing anything? Do you see anything that gives you hope that maybe this is where this is a fight, or are we still at the beginning of understanding what this is?
Well, I think, again, that this needs to be taken to the shop floor, you know, being spoken in at break rooms with employees so they understand that, you know, what Trump is doing impacts them and not in a positive sense. I have not seen anyone in labor really take up the issue of this national injunction problem. It's complicated to some extent, but it has to be explained to people. And if it's not explained, it will occur. And if it occurs, there's not much we could do to stop it. So we have to be very much involved.
Yeah. See, now I've had a couple of my lawyer friends who I've asked this question to, and I'm like, you know, so explain this to me like I don't know anything, because I don't. This sounds like a procedural thing. It just sounds like, hey, you have to put up a little bit of money before you can go forward. You know, how would this, how, if this passes, you know, what is that? What is that? What is it, I guess, is the question that I keep coming back to that gives them this kind of power. Why would the courts be neutered?
Because as it is, the federal government is controlled by the president, and he's able to enforce his will on the federal government. And then the federal government can decide whether or not it's going to give out citizenship to people, whether Social Security cards are going to be issued, whether or not there's a National Labor Relations Board. We've seen already where the president was able, Trump was able to get rid of the Federal Mediation Conciliation Services. He just fired all people there. He's fired half of the Department of Education and U.S. AID. He's fired them as well. So, you know, any fool can destroy something, and he's the biggest fool because he's intent on just destroying things that help people.
Yeah. No, as my grandfather always said, any idiot with a hammer can tear down a house. It takes a craftsman to build one. We clearly don't have a craftsman in this position right now. So I guess last question I've got for you, what do we do in this moment? Clearly the bill hasn't passed yet. The hope is that we can somehow stop it. What are the marching orders? What's the hope?
That you have an opportunity in the Senate to stop it. It clearly will fall outside of the rules of reconciliation. And there should be pressure put on Susan, you know, Murkowski, Susan Collins, some of the other Republicans that might be half rational, that may see this as something that if the Democrats win an election, that they may just get rid of the filibuster completely, or they may use the new rules to enforce things that they think are important, like global warming, you know, or DEI and stuff like that.
Yeah, this is one of those things that, you know, I don't care which side of the aisle you're on, what color hat you're wearing. This is a tool that maybe we shouldn't be giving any one person.
Well, you know, it's there are problems with courts and national injunctions, but the problem was previously it was an issue of forum shopping, that the right wing, when they wanted to stop something that Biden did, they'd go to these rural courts in Texas. And we used to call it the Supreme Court of Texas because that's where all these national rulings were made, in Armadillo, Texas, or whatever that place is called, by some federal judge who was the only judge in that circuit. And they knew that they could get good outcomes, so they did it.
Yeah, but wouldn't the argument be that, you know, Democrats could do the exact same thing, go to more urban districts and get the same kind of shopping?
We can go to San Francisco. And, you know, but the bottom line is that these tools, these injunction tools, are to give power to federal courts. Otherwise, you'll have a situation where, yes, you can have, you know, citizenship in New York, but you won't be able to necessarily get it in Arkansas. It's going to fragment the United States if that occurs.
Well, something to get to work on. Again, Section 70302, tucked in this 1,118-page bill. I had to go keyword search for it, but take a look at it for yourself. But, Seth, I appreciate the time, the input. Thanks. Seth Goldstein, partner there at the law firm of Julian Meyer, Signal, and Goldstein. I want to hear your thoughts. Is this something that concerns you? Is this something we should be really worried about based on what Seth said? I kind of think so. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. An isolated shower or two this evening, then becoming partly cloudy tonight. Lows in the low 50s. Mostly sunny, breezy, and much warmer for tomorrow. High around 80. And mid to upper 70s with sunshine for this weekend. It's 60 right now.
School sports are played by humans, coached by humans, and officiated by humans. So the next time you're sitting in the stands at a school athletic event, please remember this and maintain your humanity, especially when it comes to judging and critiquing athletes, coaches, and officials. Please show your fellow humans some respect. They'll appreciate your empathy.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So file this one under. Here we go again. As if East Palestine wasn't bad enough and all of the media attention and all of that, the deregulators are at it again. And it looks like the folks over at the Association of American Railroads pushing more deregulation on the rail industry. And you look, what we know further deregulating the rail industry poses enormous risks, dangers, health and safety risks, not just for communities, but for the workers. I know we don't think about them very often, but maybe we should. And we know without proper oversight, derailments and accidents like what happened in East Palestine are going to become much more frequent. Most of them don't get noticed like the catastrophe in Ohio, which is why I think we really have to focus on what's going on. So as the Trump administration continues its assault on sane, rational regulations, it's our job to stay informed and up to date. That's why I've asked Justin Peer to come share some thoughts with us. Justin is the National Representative of Communications for the Brotherhood of Railroad Signalmen. You can check out their website, brs.org. He's also a former signal maintainer with BASF Railway. Justin, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Brother Smith.
So walk me through what's going on here. Who let's start with first. Who are the Association of American Railroads, and what is it they want to deregulate now?
Yeah, you know, I think just to keep it in the simplest terms, the Association of American Railroads, you'll often see them referred to as AAR. They're the legislative arm of the railroad industry. So that's the force that will be going to Washington and proposing changes and they're the ones that are, you know, suggesting these severe regulations.
They're the lobbyists, in other words.
They're the lobbyists. That's right.
All right. So we've got their interest. Their interest, your interests don't align, I assume. What do they want?
Well, you know, and let's be clear here. It's not that our interests do align in the sense that we're both looking out for an efficient railroad that can bring goods to our people. They can transport our people across the country and provide, you know, a meaningful means of, you know, inner city transportation at an effective cost. And with that, regulations are something that we do agree need to have constant oversight and be reevaluated. What's happening here is the AAR is submitting to the DOT 66 regulatory changes that don't just seek to benefit the railroad industry. They really seem to be just profit driven and completely negate what the cost of public safety is going to be. And you mentioned earlier what the price is to the workers who are the ones out there maintaining the tracks and trying to ensure public safety. There's several regulations that they're going after, primarily focus on, say crossings, the frequency at which inspections are happening at crossings. And, while the technology has advanced, it still requires a person to, be there and ensure that it's operating effectively, because a lot of the systems, both are old and new and require quite an extensive, knowledge base to know how to troubleshoot them. And they're not all self-reporting and they're not all just user friendly, if you will. So the institutional knowledge that you find with signalmen is critical to keeping these systems operating safely.
It seems to me, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, it seems to me that they're trying to eliminate workers entirely. A lot of it's automated or getting down to as few workers as possible. And for the last it's got to be about 14 years now that they've been pushing for single person train crews.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's been quite some time they've been pushing for that. And the absurdity of this, it only takes a second for the public to just, would you fly on a plane that only had one pilot? Would you trust a train carrying hazardous materials going through your neighborhood with only one operator? This doesn't mind the fact that oftentimes trains are stopping over crossings. They require being split. And this allows for emergency crews to get to rural access homes. It allows children to cross the streets who commute home. Oftentimes you're seeing children crawl between trains that can't get broken due to issues with manpower or whatever. So it's just simply ludicrous, this notion of knocking trains down to one crew.
Right, and what I was gonna say with that is, there's that. There's wanting to replace, inspections of certain things with technology. It seems like we're moving towards a more automated, less human, user friendly kind of environment. Which I got to tell you, I'm not sold on the technology.
No, you're absolutely right. That is the aim here. If you get down to brass tacks, I hate to be so blunt, but profit really drives industry, and the less people they have, the less operational costs they have to maintain. And so it's hard not to see any other path here than profit driven to go down this road, because you remove the worker from the equation and you're going to have accidents.
Now, I think everyone understands, you put one person on a train, that's a bad idea. Why is it a big deal to, I guess, because I don't know what it is you guys do, and most people probably don't. Let's say we did automate a lot of what your job was as a former signal maintainer. Let's say we did replace some, manual inspections of braking systems or signals or tracking infrastructure or anything of that with automated technology. What would that look like, and how do you think it would affect, just average, average drivers, average citizens, average communities?
Yeah, sure. Just a prime example. So I was a signal maintainer in Harper, Kansas, just west of Wichita, Kansas. And out there, it's a very rural area. There are several railroad crossings that span my territory. A lot of them were private crossings for a farmer to get to and from his field from, the main highway. But a lot of them were also school crossings. And on my territory personally, I had both new installations that had happened within the last few years, and I had had crossings that I maintained that had been there for decades. And both of those types of houses have several different types of equipment that they use to monitor the track to activate to protect the public. One of the consequences of these deregulation efforts that AAR is pushing, it would require that I be at that crossing less frequently to perform my inspections. We have interval inspections, and just to keep it in a nutshell here, basically like a 30, 60, 90, 180 yearly kind of inspection. To propose that the 30-day inspection is not necessary negates considering that we deal with pest control. Not only that, we deal with, in the rural territories I come from, we deal with, teenagers vandalizing, crossing lights. You know, they're often used as target practice. And there's also environmental impacts that have, serious consequences. High winds are very famous in Harper, Kansas. And it takes nothing to take a crossing. If you're familiar, you've seen the crossing gate go down. They each have their blinking lights on the gate there. Well, those cords you see, right, they can easily become wrapped and wound around the crossing gate mechanism and prevent the gate from dropping. And, you know, the public could have no way of knowing that. And if we're not going out there as frequently as, 30 days to check on them, these inspections aren't going to get done and things like that could get missed. There's also several other more technical components that we do as part of our 30-day inspection, such as, finding grounds within the system. If there's construction going on by the city in a nearby area, that interference can impact our crossings. And without us being out there more frequently, it can be, a long time of that crossing being inoperational without us knowing it. And while you may hear that new technology allows for some of this reporting, I'll mind you, there's been this reporting around for years and the railroads haven't been using it. Not only that, they've been pending our tickets, which is basically just pushing them off until the maintainer comes back on service instead of calling them out, after hours to perform the necessary maintenance. And so, while there is the ability to report certain issues via, cellular or radio, there's not the ability to report all the issues. And some of these require a trained eye to know what they're looking for, not a computer.
It seems to me, and, help me if you think I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that, back to what you said a moment ago about it being profit-driven, it seems like they're willing to roll the dice with public safety so that their bottom line is just a margin fatter, which just seems, I don't know, it seems wrong, especially in an industry that's making as much money as the rail industry makes in this country.
Look, if I may, something that's, personal to me, about the time I hired on the railroad was when the big push for PTC was going on.
You lost me. PTC, what's that?
Yeah, so PTC is positive train control. This is a safety measure, and it's actually quite effective. In territories where we've seen it used, it can prevent a wide range of catastrophes. But it's a very technical system that basically just uses GPS and train location and signal system data to ensure that the train is doing what it's supposed to do, it's where it's supposed to be, and it's operating the direction it's supposed to be operating. If not, it is designed to stop that train. That's a great safety feature, and it was mandated federally. And when I came on in 2013, this was near the tail end of it. I was with BNSF. We were the leading railroad with installation and getting in compliance with that. With that being said, this was following Hunter Harrison, which was he's from CSX. Hunter Harrison's model for PSR, which is precision scheduled railroading. A lot of acronyms if you're not catching that already. Basically, this model was just focused on the product more than the train itself. And I don't want to get necessarily down the road on PSR, but what I do want to highlight here and what has been a hallmark of the industry since I've hired on was safety was ranked number 4 on the priority list for Hunter Harrison's model for PSR. And since I've hired on, that tracks. You can see that the focus has been driven away from safety, removing the safety teams that go out and ensure compliance. And it's been driven more towards a profit margin ratio. And it's really upsetting, too, when we come off the back of COVID and you have these railroads boasting record profits. Meanwhile, I have brothers that, are dying of sickness. And at the same time, we hear requests now from their lobbying arm that they basically want to gut our jobs. And so it's hard not to take this personal. It's hard not to be upset. But it's also very serious. It's not just a railroader issue. This is an issue for everyone. The truckers, this is an issue for them. They cross those crossings on a regular basis. This is an issue for our first responders who need to get to communities that are often divided by a railroad track. This is an issue for anybody that lives in a town or relies on public transportation, and we should all be taking it serious.
No, absolutely. And, when I hear precision scheduled railroading, I immediately think squeeze the quarter till the eagle screams. because it is all about the profit. It's all about the bottom line and not about, you know, the communities, the workers, or anyone in between. But that's just the corporate model. And as far as, you know, everyone being involved in this, yeah, this is the beginning. You guys are kind of like the canaries in the coal mine, where automation and technology, they're attempting to just squeeze out any human component. Now, look, I heard you a moment ago talk about some technology that actually works well, but with a human oversight. You know, I'm not a Luddite, but at some point, the machines aren't going to be foolproof. And I don't think at a point in my lifetime where we don't need someone overseeing them. So this idea of getting rid of people just seems way premature and also dangerous.
And, you know, and if I may, you're going to hear this phrase that I just want to go ahead and nip in the bud now. There's this new mantra you're hearing that signalmen are fixers, not finders. They want to transition us to be fixers, not finders. And what that means is a large bulk of our job is, you know, we install, maintain, and, you know, inspect these signal systems. And their suggestion is that a machine will find the issue and then we'll go fix the issue. This negates 50% of our job where we have been the ones finding the issues. And those workers, they need to stick around because this is a very critical system and we're already strapped thin. We have maintainers taking on wider territories than they ever have before. And we're seeing critical safety components get passed on because they don't have the infrastructure to replace them or the manpower to oversee them.
So if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like they're moving you guys into a more reactive role than a proactive role, which means we as the public, beware.
Yeah, you know, and railroad regulations were wrote in blood, much like many regulations. And it's unfortunate that it takes a tragedy to get the railroads to react, but oftentimes that's the only push that will get the railroad to do what they're supposed to do. And, you know, you mentioned East Palestine. There's also Gainesville, South Carolina in 2005. That's misaligned switch led to 9 deaths. Chatsworth, California, 25 dead, 100 injured. All of these things could have been prevented by the railroad following the regulations. And as you mentioned, East Palestine earlier, that one is, you know, very tragic considering that these defect detectors you may or may not have heard about. If the railroad were regulated to maintain those and install them, that would have never happened. But there is no regulation that requires that the railroads have those. And so oftentimes that's the last inspection the railroad cares that you get done. If it's broken, they say, well, push that off because, you know, you need to concentrate on your FRA inspections. So we just plead that the DOT, you know, work with us and really consider the impact that this is going to have not only to the rail industry, but to the public as well. I mean, safety is the concern here. And I said it at the top, I'll say it again. We want to take a look at regulations. If they're not effective, you know, they don't need to be there. We're not here to gum up the system. We have a vested interest that the railroads do well too, because we live in the communities that we maintain.
Yeah. But here's the thing. And you know, I hear people say that all the time. Wow, we need to get rid of bad regulation. Well, I'm a little more leery of that. I'm a little more of the regulations just didn't pop up. Something bad happened. Something
That's right.
terrible happened to make our members of Congress or legislative bodies go, hey, there ought to be a regulation. It didn't just go, hey, I've got a whim today. Let's do this maliciously. No, somebody died. And as you pointed out, you know, all these regulations are written in blood. So before we go ripping them out, you know, I'm a little more cautious. And I know it That's might right. cost a penny or two more, but it's nowhere near what we hear the ARA or other organizations whining about.
That's right. That's right. You know, and at the end of the day, when you're boasting that big of a profit margin, you certainly could take the time to care about public safety.
Yeah, especially the people who you called heroes and frontline heroes and essential and all that during COVID. I know we've forgotten that. We've moved past it. So last question I've got for you, what do we do? I mean, clearly they've got a lot of money. It's an enormously profitable industry. The lobbying arm is pushing with an administration that is extremely friendly to taking a chainsaw to regulations. What do we do? How do we fight back? How do we stop this?
Yeah. So I'll say first and foremost, you know, we maintain to be committed to the current safety regulations. You know, they're proven necessary. They're proven effective. They've been saving lives. We're going to keep fighting the fight. We're going to continue asking other labor unions to join us, but the public can get involved too. As much as you may or may not believe it, getting a hold of your state and federal legislators, calling and talking to their staffers and informing them on these issues and why they're important to you goes a really long way. You know, we're just a labor organization of 10,000. We pale in comparison to some of these bigger names, but one thing I've found is persistence leads to change, and we're asking the public to take up that torch too. You know, this is a vested interest for all of us.
There you go. Justin Peer, I appreciate the time. National Representative of Communications with the Brotherhood of Railroad Signalmen. You can check out their website, brs.org. We'll get links out. Justin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. What do you think? With East Palestine in the rearview mirror, they really think now's a good time? Probably. Our memories are very short. I want to hear your thoughts. rick@therickssmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. That was the day that the animators at Walt Disney went out on strike. Attempts to organize a union for cartoonists had begun a decade earlier, resulting in the formation of the Screen Cartoonists Guild in 1938. Then, in 1941, Warner Brothers locked out its Looney Tunes cartoonists for joining the guild. But after 6 days, the company gave in to the union. That set the stage for a showdown at Disney. In its early days, the Disney Company had a reputation as a good employer. Walt Disney provided profit sharing for its cartoonists. But with the success of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Disney started putting more of the profits into a new studio. The workplace became more corporate and hierarchical. Employees became increasingly frustrated with the wide differences in pay various animators earned. Art Babbitt, the highest-paid animator on the staff, decided to sign up with the Cartoonists Guild. He was quickly fired. Outraged, 200 cartoonists walked off the job. The strike waged on for 5 weeks. A federal mediator was brought in and sided with the union on almost every issue. The strike even managed to make its way into one of Disney's movies. At the time of the work action, the company was creating the circus-based cartoon film Dumbo. Some of the non-union cartoonists put in a scene where a group of clowns go to ask the boss for a big raise. The scene was meant to poke fun at the union.
Look out! Look out! Big elephants on parade, here they come, hippity-hoppity, they're here, and there are big elephants everywhere.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
In great big elephants on parade.
What'll I do? What'll I do? What an unusual view.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, much like privatization, deregulation is one of those things that, you know, they sell you a nice bill of goods. Looks good. It's, you know, they show like three-card Monte. They show you this side. They never show you that side. And look, understand, the legislative lobbying arm of the railroad industry, they have their priorities, and their priorities are all about money. It's all about fattening the bottom line. It's all about squeezing that quarter till the eagle screams. It's all about maximizing shareholder wealth. Workers concerned be damned, you know, consumers be damned. All of that's secondary. And as you heard Justin say, you know, when they came in with that precision scheduled railroading, safety was fourth on the list. And I got to be honest, a little surprised it was that high. Because that's someone else's problem. That's not their problem. And this is where my problem when mass consolidation, monopolization, like we're seeing on the railroads, this consolidation over the last 50 years, not good for the industry. The enormous amount of power that we give a handful of corporations over our entire economy, kind of frightening. But for me, the idea of more deregulation means, well, the pendulum swings back to the moneyed interests. And working people, again, we'll take it on the chin. For me, workplace safety is front and foremost. That's it. And with less regulations, we know those are less safe workplaces. We know that. And I'm more on the side of regulating than deregulating for the sole purpose of, as I said, some bad stuff happened. We can't, this idea of, you know, the industry will do the right thing because they're afraid of being sued or bad PR. Nonsense. They don't care. Look what happened after East Palestine. They threw a little bit of money, made some parks, they painted stuff, they handed out a couple of checks, and they went back to doing what they were doing. Congress didn't pass any significant changes. And now they're back taking another bite at the apple because they want more deregulation. And as I said, we know less safe workplaces, more inequality. Big corporations will continue to crush the little guys. We'll see monopoly and market dominance by a handful. And this isn't just the railroad industry. This is across the spectrum. You have got an administration with the Trump administration who there isn't a regulation they like. Which means, you know, down the road, the damage will be felt for decades. Because who knows when the next East Palestine, who knows when the next savings and loan or the next bank collapse, or go down the list of tragedies of the past that we passed legislation or passed regulations from environmental to workplace to consumer. We know. And the sad reality is what I heard from Justin is that the industry is coming out and saying, look, we're going to go away from proactive, stuff. And we're going to just be reactive. We're going to get rid of these signalmen who are supposed to go out there and find these problems. We're going to rely on technology that may or may not work. And well, we'll clean up the mess later because we can save a dime today. I got to be honest, the neglect of public health to me just doesn't warrant such a thing. And what we get out of these lobbying arms is this really short-term thinking of, you know, how do we make more? And how do we cut our costs? How do we put more profit in our pockets, cut our costs, which means workers. Now, on the grander scheme, these workers right now, they're the front line. AI, technology, automation, robotics, all of this stuff, it's coming. And how we allow it to start will dictate, well, how we end up. Are we going to allow industries to go and buy their way into getting whatever they want through a very pliable Congress right now? An administration where pay for play is on the table? You know, maybe donate some money to my crypto. Maybe give us some money for my kids' vulture capitalist scheme. Maybe, you know, Ivanka and Jared, they're still in the picture. You don't think they've disappeared? They were just smart enough to stay out of government. And you know what's weird? What's really bizarre to me? We don't hear any of the talk of nepotism. We don't hear any of the talk of, you remember all of the Hunter Biden and the Jim Biden talk? Oh, they're profiting off of Joe Biden's name. I guess, you know, and this is where I think Mike Johnson, you know, who I think is a charlatan, where I think he was at least honest. He said, you know, they were trying to, you know, do that in the back rooms. You know, Donald Trump's right out in front with his grift. I guess they publish their prices. I don't know. But for us, we the working people, the people who live in these communities where they're going to leave us vulnerable. And as I keep saying, look, we might not be able to stop this. And we may have to suffer. We may see the next East Palestine. And I don't know that will be enough. The question I have, and I hope we get people motivated around, is how do we use that? How do we stop the bad from happening? And when bad happens, how do we organize around it to fix it down the road or down the track in this instance? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The Trump administration has made it clear it wants to crack down on visas for foreign students. State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce.
The visa process is a key component of keeping the country safe. It is not targeted at certain only specific individuals. This is an overarching national security action.
The U.S. will revise the visa criteria for all future applicants from the People's Republic of China and Hong Kong. On the day of Harvard's commencement, a federal judge temporarily extends an order blocking the Trump administration from banning the university from enrolling international students. CBS's Nikki Batiste.
President Trump has argued that no more than about 15% of Harvard's admission spots should go to international students. But there are statistics that show international students, international graduates contribute to the economy. And most foreign students at universities across the country do.